Welcome to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Kurt Reinhardt, chief engineer with the Miami Conservancy District, will tell us about the great flood, how devastation turned to innovation. That's coming up in Sochi Talks. Also, Emily McCord speaks with the Fordham Institute's Terry Ryan and Steve Farkas about a study they've conducted on education reforms. Up first, last week, the IRS admitted that they targeted Tea Party and other conservative groups who filed for tax-exempt status. It's a complaint that these singled-out groups have had for more than a year, but it only gained traction in the media when the IRS apologized for their actions. Reactions came in throughout the week. President Obama said he only learned about the scandal when the story broke in the media. Later, Senator Rob Portman said he doesn't believe that. Portman says he wrote a letter last March in 2012 asking why the IRS was delaying tax-exempt applications for the targeted groups. Former Ohio House member Seth Morgan with Americans for Prosperity says it isn't just conservatives that should be worried by the actions of the IRS. We spoke with him on this week's Politics Ohio.
Well, I think this is really an example of government that has grown too big for its own britches, Jerry. You know, a lot of folks have focused on these conservative groups and other groups that have been targeted by the IRS. But this is really, I think, an American issue, an issue that points to really what happens when government feels like that they're exempted from their own laws, that they're large enough to just make their own decisions about without the accountability of the American people or a constitution. And I think that's really what makes this such an egregious issue, whether it was a liberal organization or a conservative organization, for any department of government to make decisions based off of philosophical bent is problematic for the maintenance of liberty in America.
Fox 19 out of Cincinnati is reporting that they're in contact with four employees who worked at the Cincinnati IRS office in the exempt organization department, and those four employees say they were just doing what their bosses told them to do. That seems more likely than just a few low-level employees acting on their own behalf.
I think as this story continues to progress, I think we're going to see more and more. And I think the Obama administration, being the chief administrator for the federal government, owes it to the American people to launch an investigation that is even separate and distinct from his own administration for accountability purposes, and I hope he does that. It appears already that there was knowledge at a higher level in the Internal Revenue Service than those four employees, and I would expect that you would see that. I mean, most organizations, it would be shocking to me that four low-level employees conspired together in Cincinnati, especially when you had the number of conservative organizations that you did that were either held back or given greater examination on these applications for tax-exempt status. You know, John Boehner, I think, said it right when he said, this isn't a question of who's being fired. This is a question of who should be in jail.
Don Birdsall with the Dayton Tea Party says they filed papers with the IRS to be granted tax-exempt status in 2011. Several months later, they received, quote, a very intrusive questionnaire from the IRS official in Cincinnati, which inquired about matters far beyond the necessary scope of IRS oversight, unquote. The Dayton Tea Party withdrew their application for that tax-exempt status. And let's talk a little bit about how other groups have been affected in terms of fundraising and organization.
Yes, that's right. Matter of fact, I talked to Don Birdsall about that situation with the Dayton Tea Party, and I mean, I'll be honest with you, Jerry. I mean, I hear a lot of complaining, and it's easy for people to get mad at the IRS. And I thought to myself the first time I heard the complaint, well, this may just be a lack of understanding of how much of a pain in the rear end the IRS can be at times. And then when I saw the actual letter that they were sending to these groups, I was just completely shocked, because it was clear that they were on a fishing expedition that had nothing to do with the exemption purpose for which these groups were filing. And, I mean, it was more intrusive than many audit letters I've seen. This was not your run-of-the-mill questionnaire that the IRS was using to ferret out whether or not these groups should be tax-exempt. They were clearly seeking for something, and it appeared pretty obvious that it was political. And now, as history always proves truth to be right, now history is showing that is exactly what they were doing, was trying to prove that. And so your question to the effect, I mean, you had groups like the Dayton Tea Party who just walked off that pathway. They were literally stopped by overzealous bureaucrats that appears reaches to the top level of the Obama administration because they appeared to be political in nature. and political in nature, by the way, opposed in general rhetoric to the administration. And so, yeah, it has affected folks in all kinds of different ways. But what is common among them is a great source of frustration and a whole lot of time that, frankly, the federal government had no business putting back on those organizations.
The IRS will play a significant role in also oversight of the Affordable Care Act, correct?
Well, that is correct. And that's the way it's currently written today. I know there's some members of Congress that are floating a different idea. Of course, I think this is, again, an example, Jerry, of what happens when government grows outside its bounds. And I think the entire Affordable Care Act is an example of government growing outside its bounds. But to the extent that it is the rule of the land and the law of the land today, which we would love to see overturned and repealed, but to the extent that from an enforcement capacity to turn that over to the Internal Revenue Service should scare every American.
I've been speaking with former Republican state lawmaker, now with Americans for Prosperity, is Seth Morgan. Seth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Jerry, really appreciate it.
The IRS official in charge of the tax-exempt organizations during the time when Tea Party groups were targeted now runs the IRS office responsible for administering the Affordable Care Act. Her name is Sarah Hall Ingram. This week it was announced that two IRS execs would resign because of the scandal, but now some are calling for Ingram's removal from office, and it may be toward her that eyes turn if criminal charges are sought. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. A new study released this week by the Fordham Institute gauged Ohio superintendents' views on education reform in the state. Emily McCord spoke to the Fordham Institute's Terry Ryan and the lead researcher on the project, Steve Farkas. Terry Ryan begins by explaining the purpose of the study.
Well, we think it important that in the state where we have so many reforms underway that we gauge kind of where the folks out in the field are on these issues, because at the end of the day, for them to be successfully implemented, the sort of frontline educators need to buy into it. And that's what the superintendents in the state are. They are the sort of the commanders in chief for their districts. And if reform policies are going to make a difference and last, it's important that ultimately they work at fruitfully implementing them. That was the logic behind the study.
What issues did this study look at specifically?
So we looked at seven big reforms. The first are the Common Core Academic Standards in Mathematics and English Language Arts. The second are teacher evaluations. Third, we looked at the third grade reading guarantee. Fourth, we looked at A to F ratings for schools and school districts. Fifth, we looked at open enrollment and the policies around open enrollment. Sixth, we looked at blended learning opportunities. Those are opportunities that marry classroom with technology. And then the seventh thing that we looked at was school choice, both charters and vouchers.
One of the findings of this study was that superintendents favor the implementation of Common Core, and that's been controversial. I know that some conservatives have been worried that it's a top-down approach from Washington, and that there's also concerns about implementation. What are superintendents saying?
Superintendents don't see it as something that's being foisted upon them by Washington, D.C., because they know that it has come from the state and state level. And so what superintendents are saying is that they support the standards. So they think the standards, which are basically the academic goals that we expect of kids in reading and mathematics, they think the standards are better than what Ohio currently has. And they think the standards are worth their time, energy, effort, and money to work towards. And so they support the standards. That's clear in this survey. And that's important in regards to the controversy that's going on around it. That said, they do worry about implementation and some of the challenges around implementation. Specifically, they are worried about the assessments. They've seen some of the test questions, but they haven't seen the assessments in their entirety, and they're not able to sort of gauge what they're doing with a complete understanding of what the tests are going to look like. That said, even despite their concerns with implementation, they think that the Common Core is a positive, and they think 5 years from now it's going to be in place and it's worth pursuing. I think they would also like the state to help pay for some of the costs, especially as it relates to things like technology. And they're worried about that.
I want to talk to you, Steve Farkas. You're the president of the FDR Group, and you conducted the study. If 56% of superintendents participated in this, is that an accurate gauge of the attitudes of superintendents statewide?
We were actually quite pleased with the response rate, considering it pretty high. And it was actually higher than we had done a survey in a couple of years ago of Ohio superintendents. And this response rate was even higher, and we're comfortable with the representation that we got, that, and in terms of the demographic characteristics of the superintendents, they were pretty well aligned with what the population of superintendents is in Ohio.
In general, Common Core was one that superintendents were optimistic about. What other areas were perhaps not as popular with superintendents?
One of the areas that I think has a lot of is getting a lot of press and a lot of attention is the value-added assessments in evaluating Ohio's teachers, meaning that teachers are going to be evaluated now. Half of their rating at the end of the year will be based on the progress that their students make in terms of their test scores. So you take a snapshot at the beginning of the year, you take another snapshot later on, and then you look for growth and you assess the students, and from that you derive a kind of a measure of how well the teacher has been doing his or her job. So the new policy that's enacted into law is that teacher evaluations must take into account the progress of students in terms of test scores. 42% of superintendents say that this change will lead to fundamental improvement in Ohio's education system, and 51% doubt that it will.
So not a majority there?
Not a majority. And the real problem seems to be implementation concerns. 86% say that there's going to be too much pressure on their principals because of the observation requirements. 85% say it's going to be too hard to measure growth in certain subjects like art. How am I going to, one superintendent told me in an interview, how am I going to show that a child's progress in art, in terms of an art project from one at the beginning of the year to the next? 93% say that there are going to be a lot of legal challenges when you evaluate teachers, at least in part based on their test scores of their students. There are going to be challenges to by the teachers themselves. So they see a lot of implementation problems down the line, and it behooves Ohio's legislators and Ohio superintendents to get together and see how do we make this happen in a way that will not stymie reform.
Terry Ryan, I want to ask you, what's the takeaway from this? What can we glean from this study?
I think the main takeaway here is that there is a disconnect when it comes to some of the policies that are being implemented and put in place by Ohio's lawmakers and the field. And you see the disconnect in terms of the ability or the desire of superintendents to actually want to put in place these reforms that they're being told by the General Assembly they must put in place. So in some instances, the field, the superintendents, are more receptive, open, and have bought into the reforms. The best example are the Common Core academic standards and better example, blended learning. So they're buying into these reforms, and they're going to own them, and they're going to run with them, it sounds like. Some other reforms that are coming out of Columbus, the third grade reading guarantee is one, A to F rating of schools and districts, and school choice, charter schools and vouchers. With those policies, there's less support, far less support and buy-in from the field. So it's going to be harder and it's going to take more time for those to, in effect, bite and to ultimately become commonplace. And what we would say is there needs to be more conversation and there needs to be more dialogue between those out in the field and those making the laws. I think that's probably the biggest takeaway here is that reforms really are going to last if you have people out in the field who bought into them.
Emily McCord speaking with Fordham Institute's Terry Ryan and Steve Farkas. We should note that the Fordham Institute, who did the study, is a supporter of Common Core, and opponents suggest that many schools are more in favor of the funding attached to the program rather than the curriculum standards. It will be interesting to see how this plays out. This is WISO Weekend. This week, Soshi Talks returns to WYSO. Soshi Talks is a collaboration with the Southwest Ohio Council for Higher Education. Once a month, we'll hear from faculty and staff from area colleges and universities on a variety of subjects. It's an effort to bring Miami Valley research and thinking into the public arena, a way to enlighten the world with local knowledge. This week, Kurt Reinhart, chief engineer with the Miami Conservancy District, presents The Great Flood, How Devastation Turned to Innovation.
Started in March 1913 with a storm system that dumped between 8 and 11 inches of rain over southwest Ohio, a storm that actually affected states from Oklahoma and Kansas through Ohio and into Pennsylvania, very widespread storm. The worst of it was right here in southwest Ohio in the Dayton area. The community in Dayton and surrounding communities were used to flooding. There had been at least 10 floods since Dayton was settled in 1796, so about every 10 to 12 years they could expect flooding in downtown, but nothing prepared them for the devastation of March 1913. The water started rising. It started raining on Easter Sunday, March 23rd. The river started rising. By Tuesday the 25th, the entire city was engulfed with water. If you think about Dayton and you draw a circle from Dayton Art Institute to Children's Medical Center to Stivers High School for the Arts to Wright Dunbar neighborhood back to Grandview Hospital, more than a mile wide circle, all that area was underwater. Downtown Dayton, as much as 10 feet at 3rd and Main, some of the other areas in the city were 17 to 20 feet deep of water. So massive devastation throughout the community. More than 300 people in southwest Ohio that were killed. There was more than $100 million in damages, and that's 1913 economy. Today we're talking in the billions of dollars in damages just in southwest Ohio. So as you can imagine, a major life-altering event to the citizens of Dayton and the surrounding communities. Rescue and relief efforts began immediately. John Patterson at NCR headed up the relief, built boats to send out into the community to rescue people that were stranded in buildings, stranded on rooftops, set up a hospital, a morgue, kitchens to feed the people, housing for the people, built a tent city on the NCR campus, which was south of town and did not flood. So it was a place for everyone to go to get away from the flood. The flood itself only lasted less than a week. By the next week, the water was down out of the city, but the devastation left behind from overturned buildings, burned out buildings where gas lines had exploded, to inches and even feet of nasty, smelly, yucky mud left behind covering everything. So the cleanup effort was huge. The community had experienced some flooding in the past, but were not ready for this. But here's where it really talks about the spirit of the community, because they said, this cannot happen again. We're not going to live with this. We got to find a solution. Right away, everybody started coming up with ideas. They formed a flood prevention committee. The first thing they decided they needed to do was raise funds to come up with a solution. They started soliciting funds. They had rallies at the old courthouse at 3rd and Main, solicited funds from the community, from the very people that just suffered death and destruction from their families and their properties, and said, please donate to this cause. Within 2 months after the flood, by the end of May 1913, they had raised over $2 million for the flood prevention effort. Once again, 1913 dollars. That's like starting a campaign today and raising $50 million in donations within the next 2 months. It's just an amazing effort just in fundraising. They accomplished their goal. They got their money. They said, where do we go from here? The flood prevention community started looking, and they hired an engineer from Memphis, Tennessee, Arthur Morgan, who had worked in drainage and different water-related engineering projects. He came to Dayton and immediately started driving up and down the valley, looking at where the flooding was, what the devastation was, the topography of the Miami Valley and the Great Miami River, and came back to the committee within a couple months, said he had looked at a variety of solutions from wider river channels, diverting the river, building levees. His proposal was extremely radical at the time. He proposed building a series of large dams in rural areas that would hold back large amounts of water only during the flood, but the rest of the time the dams would not perform any other function, so they'd be dry dams. Working in conjunction with the dams would be levees and channel improvements to pass the water from the rainfall. Immediately everybody said, this is unproven, nobody's ever tried something like this, this is a crazy idea. So instead of bowing to pressure, Arthur Morgan brought in what he called a board of consulting engineers. He invited top engineers from academia, from federal government, from around the country, and some of them were his largest critics that said, this has never been tried, this will not work. Brought them together, presented a lot of information about his investigations, why they came to this conclusion. By the end of this series of meetings, the board of consulting engineers endorsed this plan and said, this is a great idea. This will work. Okay, now they got an idea. It's a few months after the flood. It's late in 1913. So they really had three major hurdles. Number one, legal. There was no legal way to build this system. Number two, financial. How are they going to pay for it? And then number three was technical. Okay, we've promised this really creative flood protection system. It's got dams. It's got levees. How is it actually going to work? The legal challenges they set about, and all these things were resolved concurrently. They didn't do one, then the other. It was concurrently. So the legal challenges, they wrote a new law for the state of Ohio that was enacted in 1914 called the Ohio Conservancy Act. And what it did was allow for creation of a new special purpose regional district that was separate from the cities, separate from the counties, but had certain powers that could address these flooding problems. The key things were it could cross city boundaries, it could cross county boundaries, it could incorporate multiple jurisdictions, it had the power to levy assessments, had the power to take properties, own properties, and build and maintain this flood protection system. As I said, it was passed into law in 1914. As with any major sweeping legislation, it was immediately challenged by a lot of different groups, withstood many court challenges. It was finally upheld by the Ohio Supreme Court in 1915. At that time, the leaders said, okay, we've met the court challenges, and they petitioned what's called the Conservancy Court, which was a new body formed from existing judges from the counties, to form the Miami Conservancy District. So the district was formed in 1915 to move forward with the challenge of building flood protection. The second challenge, obviously, was financial. How do you pay for this thing? Well, fortunately, the law was written that allowed the Conservancy District to levy assessments on properties and political subdivisions that benefit from the flood protection system. So with this, they started looking at what would be the value of flood protection to the communities. They hired appraisers, and they appraised nearly 80,000 properties throughout the watershed that were either affected by the flooding or would be affected by the flood protection system, came back with a report, which is called the appraisal record, that said, this is the benefit based on the damage the property suffered, the loss of value to the property because of the flood, and the future increase in value of the property once the flood protection system is in place. And that was the basis for the benefits to individual properties from this flood protection system. At the same time, they had established benefits to the cities and counties, not only for flooding of municipal buildings, firehouses, parks, that type of thing, but also prevention of flooding and damage to the streets, the bridges, the sewers, the water lines, the fact that they would not have to respond to flooding, close roads, rescue people, the associated disease and destruction, and also the loss of business, the effect on the economy if all of a sudden businesses cannot get loans because their buildings are washed away, entire manufacturing plants that are shut down due to flooding. So there was this whole economic piece that by establishing benefits to the properties and to the cities and counties allowed the Conservancy District to levy an assessment. With this assessment, started in 1919, they sold bonds to build the flood protection system and then paid for, between 1919 and 1949, paid the almost $31 million capital cost to build the flood protection system. Those assessments continue today at a much lower rate for operation, maintenance, the flood protection. So what was devised back in 1917 to pay for the system still pays for that operation and maintenance. The third challenge, maybe the biggest one of all, was the technical challenge. Okay, we've got this promise of dams and levees and this integrated flood protection system that holds back water without manual interruption. How is this really going to work? How are we really going to build this? A lot of challenges or a lot of difficulties. An example, Arthur Morgan believed in what he called conclusive engineering analysis. Everything he studied, all the nuances to make sure that the best possible alternative that could financially and realistically be built was incorporated in the plan. And once the plans were designed, he didn't just stop there. The engineering staff and the construction staff had the ability to come back and say, okay, we're building this, but here's something better that will work. Let's incorporate this into the plan. So it was an ongoing engineering that allowed the flood protection system to be designed and built like it was. Another example was the hydraulics of the dams and the stilling basins at the dams, which captured the kinetic energy of the flowing water and slowed it down so you didn't have erosion. There was theory, but nobody had ever built a system like this. So they built scale models and modeled them in Colonel Edward Deed's swimming pool to see how these dams would actually work and did physical models to design the dam. Once all this was done, they were getting ready to start construction when World War I in Europe drug the United States into the conflict. There was a shortage of manpower. There was a shortage of equipment. So the entire project basically was on hold for a year while they were finishing the design, but they were gearing up for construction. 1919, the conflict in Europe was over. United States was again at peace, and construction started. In the time from 1919 to 1922, there was about a three-year span where all this came together. Construction of all the dams and levees at all the cities was all done concurrently, and the project was completed by 1922, less than 10 years after the flood. One of the things during construction of the dams was they were in rural areas away from the cities, and Arthur Morgan believed that having itinerant camps where people, itinerant workers would come in, payroll would happen, you know, they'd get their money every couple of weeks. The gambling, the prostitution, the alcohol, violence, all that broke out. That was typical of construction camps of the day. Arthur Morgan said this is not a good way to do business. He designed small villages. His wife, Lucy, actually designed the houses, and they built villages at each dam for workers to come to bring their family. They had schools, they had clinics, they had groceries, they had a community center at each village. These were thriving villages during construction. Once the project was done, there was no longer a use. The buildings were sold, the community centers and the schools and the clinics closed, and people moved away. But it brought those people to the community that became part of the community, and many of them stayed in the Dayton area. So, briefly, wrapping it up, successfully within 10 years, they went from devastation like the community had never seen to a brand new concept, state-of-the-art flood protection system that today, nearly 100 years later, has successfully prevented floods more than 1,700 times in Dayton and the other communities along the Great Miami River.
Kurt Reinhardt, chief engineer with the Miami Conservancy District. You can find out more about Soshi Talks at soshi.org. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
This week on American Roots, it's about words and story and song. We'll talk with Roseanne Cash about her memoir. And New Orleans blues man Little Freddie King spins a barnyard tale. Plus songs from Bob Dylan, Tom Waits, and Mavis Staples. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up this afternoon at 2 on your public radio station, 91.3 WYSO.